So this morning, I want to give a follow-up talk to a talk I gave a while ago about anxiety as the essence of suchness. And so first I'm going to read from Dogen, Zen teacher Dogen. We intrinsically have the countenance of the person of suchness, and so need not be anxious about the essence of suchness. Because anxiety is itself the essence of suchness, it is not anxiety. Is that clear so far? Moreover, we need not be startled by the essence of suchness being this way. Even if suchness appears startling and suspicious, it is suchness all the same. There is that suchness by which you ought to be startled. Okay, so I gave a talk on this, what, a month or two ago maybe? And I had some follow-up questions, so I thought I would try to deal with some of those follow-up questions. So, first of all, so what's he saying here? What's he saying? He's saying that we don't need to improve ourselves in order to be whole. We don't need to change ourselves one iota in order to be whole. We've got anxiety. That's part of our wholeness. We've got fear. That's part of our wholeness. We don't have to do a thing because we're whole already. Including the anxiety, including the fear, including the elation, including the boredom. So that's what he's saying, okay? And that's where practice begins, with that sort of at least intellectual acknowledgement. Because it's hard to acknowledge that at an emotional level because it's sort of counterintuitive for most of us. And that we should not move away from the simple impact of the wide embrace of suchness. We're always being embraced by suchness. By isness, by the interdependence of all life. And the metaphor that I use all the time, that I get right out of the sutras, is the waves in the ocean, right? All the time I use that. There are lots of waves on the ocean of being. Anxiety, happiness, fear, love, desire, memory. But there, and each of those waves we see as separate waves. Sure, they're each separate waves, but they're also the entire ocean, each of them. And so this practice is learning how to surf. It's learning how to surf, realizing that the waves are the ocean, that each, even that awful wave that keeps coming up and knocking us over, that's the ocean. How are we going to surf it? All right. Well, we start off maybe with a boat, then we get down to a surfboard when we're brave, and then when we're really ready to do shikantaza, we're just there with it. Shikantaza, bear attention, right? So the rest of my talk then is going to be about surfing, okay? I'm a California boy, you know. Not a boy anymore, but still feel like a California boy. In my comments today, I'm going to rely somewhat on the work of the PESCI group, P-E-S-C-I, psychologists with a Buddhist orientation. You know, there are more psychologists with a Buddhist orientation around than you would expect. There are a whole bunch of them by now. So first of all, anxiety, fear. It sounds an alarm. That alarm is instinctually based to deal with danger. But it also sounds an alarm in the absence of danger. It gives us a false signal. which we treat as danger, often when it's not danger. Often when it's just a signal which is not about something that's dangerous. And the worst feature of anxiety, especially if there's a pattern or prolonged, or fear, if there's a habitual fear, is our attempt to get away from it, our attempt to protect ourselves from it. So for Dogen, in the 13th century, knowing nothing about Western psychology, his shikan taza, his bare attention, is not to protect ourselves from anything by minimizing or avoiding. Now he doesn't talk about the difference between something that's a real danger and just an alarm directly, but indirectly he does. In Bendawa, which we were studying in study group, he says that he kind of puts down reciting Buddha's name or reciting mantras or doing ritual, and he says only shikan, only bare attention, will help you realize anxiety as suchness, fear as suchness, joy as suchness. Realize the wave as the ocean. So the practice of Zen really is a practice of what? It's a practice of reversing the process that creates and maintains this dysfunctional fear that most of you guys carry around a lot of the time, that most human beings carry around a lot of the time. That's the process. That's our process. And it takes a while. It takes commitment. It's confusing. This is the process we go through, and actually it works. It works. So the traditional view that we tend to have toward anxiety and fear, well, in Western thought, what do we say in Western thought? Existential movement, which I was very involved in when I was young. Starting with Soren Kierkegaard, fear and trembling. Fear and trembling and anxiety are the nature of what it is to be human. So get used to it, honey. That shadow you're going to carry around for your whole life, it's what being human is about, and that's not what Dogen's talking about. It's a different kind of getting. It's a resignation. It's a saying there's nothing more than this. Just to be human is to be. Ugh. We don't believe that. We don't believe that. We believe you can experience for yourself the whole ocean right in that wave. Because it is the whole ocean. It's exactly the same stuff. You just tricked yourself. Your mind has played a trick on itself. You've taken something which is just uncomfortable and said that it's dangerous. It's not dangerous. Yes, once in a while your fears... Sometimes your fears, sometimes your anxieties are about something that's really dangerous. But how much of the time? 5% of the time? 8% of the time? 10% of the time? Now, maybe if you're in Iraq right now, maybe 90% of the time, but we're not in Iraq, you guys. We're sitting by a beautiful lake here in the middle of Minneapolis on a 70-degree sunny day. You're just making this stuff up. And you've been making it up for your whole lives. You've tricked yourselves. You've tricked yourselves. And Zen is about seeing that trick and seeing through it and being free from it just by seeing through it. Just by seeing through it. So we respond in ways that make the anxiety worse, that make the fear worse. One thing is, even if we don't believe in Western thoughts starting with existentialism and Freud. Freud did not improve on things. He didn't. He said the best the ego can do is maintain a truce in the war between the id and the superego. That's the best ego can do. Because id, our libidinal desires, right? And then our ideal parental self are always struggling. The should and the instinctual needs. And Freud said the best you can do is maintain a truce. So when I was in my early 20s, and maybe by my mid-20s, my father knew that I was doing this stuff because it was hard for him not to know that I was doing this stuff because it was my life. He said, Tim, I just want you to know that I think what you're pursuing is not possible. That you need to realize that lots of people are into this religious stuff and they think they can get some peace of mind. But he said, Tim, I've been around a long time and there's no such thing as enduring peace of mind. You maybe can get it for a second, but then it's gone. He said, you're going to waste your life doing this. That's what my father said to me when I was 22. And I've since wasted my life. And I couldn't be happier about it. Sorry, Dad. I couldn't be happier about it, you guys. So maybe we don't buy into our cultural myths, our Freudian, our existential, our whatever cultural myths, right? But then we maybe have some personal thing. We're carrying around personal tapes about, oh, I'm not good enough. She's good enough, but I'm not good enough. She can calm her mind, but not my mind. I can't do it. I'm weak. My mind is all over the place. My emotions are so sticky. It's impossible for me. So, you may carry that around with you. And so then just notice that. Just notice that you're doing that. So, we make ourselves worse as a result of this so-called recovery effort that we do. We do that. So, the PESI group talks about the scary movie analogy. Scary movie analogy. So, we go to scary movies. We go to scary movies. We get scared in scary movies. We think it's danger when it's not danger, when it's discomfort. And we like to go to those. Some people do. Not all of us. Summertime is for scary movies, right? So we allow ourselves to be tricked when we're in the movie theater. We like being tricked in the movie theater because we know it's just a trick. But we don't realize that we're tricking ourselves all the time. Most of the time. 50% of the time. 70% of the time. Outside of the movie theater. And if we can realize it's a trick within the movie theater, can we realize it's a trick right here and right now? Can we realize that? Yes, it's possible. Yes, it's possible. So for danger, what? What did you learn when you took Psychology 101? Fight, flight, freeze. Freeze, flight, fight, right? Those are the three things we do. But we don't need to do those for discomfort. We don't need to do those for discomfort. For discomfort, bear attention. Of course, I'm Zen, right? So bear attention. Shikan. If that doesn't sound very helpful to you, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Can't help it. What's good for danger is the opposite of what's good for discomfort. If we're in Iraq, we need fight, flight, freeze. We want to stay alive, right? We want to get home. We need it all the time. We're in danger. When we're sitting by Lake Calhoun on an August day, when it's 70 degrees, we don't need it. We don't need it. So our coping methods are part of the problem. which mistake, maintain this mistake that we make, this cognitive mistake, this perceptual mistake of high risk when there is very little risk at all. So, as many of you know, I injured my back, and for a month ago, I injured my back, and I really injured my back, because I've had back pain before, but this time I really injured my back, so that I was prone, and then I was on crutches, and et cetera, et cetera. So, so every night for about the last month, almost every night, I wake up in the middle of the night in pain. Sometimes at 1 a.m., sometimes at 2 a.m., sometimes I get till 3 a.m. and then I've been up for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or 4 hours, and that's the pattern. That's a pattern, and everybody tells me, "Oh, that's the accepted pattern. You know, that's what happens." Okay, thanks. Bear attention, I guess, right? Bear attention. That's the pattern, because I'm lying in one position. You know, if I moved around when I slept, maybe it wouldn't happen so much. So, and so, after this has been going on for a while, I'm 66 years old. I never experienced much pain, much physical pain in my life before now. So here's my opportunity to be really empathic with other people, right? So after it's going on for like a couple of weeks, I'm a little anxious about lying down or going to bed at night. I'm a little anxious about that. Do I want to try this? So I have choices, right? I can watch TV instead of lying down. Maybe I just watch TV. Just flip channels or find some TV show that arrests my attention enough that I kind of zone out or something, right? Or, I can take a pain med. Of course, I'm not in pain yet. I'm just anxious about my pain, right? But I could take a pain med and anticipate, well, take my pain med. But those are not the way that Dogen recommends, either of those. Not the way I recommend. Did I try those? I think I did the TV one night, and I didn't even do the pain med. I did the TV one night. But instead, I'm a Zen teacher, I'm a Zen student, so I just lie down, and I breathe, and I pay attention to my body, and I watch the pain ebb and flow, and it's not so bad when I'm first lying down anyway, and then I go to sleep. And it usually didn't take me more than 5 minutes, because I'm a pretty good meditator. And then I wake up at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., or 3 a.m., but at least I don't have the extra part of the anxiety about the pain that just becomes worse and worse because I've stayed up watching TV till 3 a.m. and then I'm exhausted and then I really need to take a pain med. Then I have to take a second pain med because I'm so exhausted I can't get to sleep. Do you know what I mean? How we get caught in this on and on and on? Yeah. So avoidance and escape is what we need to pay attention to. Avoidance and escape. And a definition of a well-trained Zen priest might be that instead of avoiding and escaping something that's just a trick, we are there with it. We're compassionately and attentively there with it in seeing that it's just a trick. And then when we see that, we see that the wave is the ocean. We just see that. We experience that as soon as we notice it's a trick. So, fight, flight, and freeze I'm not from Minnesota, but I've lived here a long time. Minnesota, in interpersonal relationships, we emphasize the flight interpersonally as Minnesotans. I'm generalizing, but we do emphasize. Where Minnesota nice really emphasizes the flight, whereas other parts of the country I've been in, and I'm not going to go into them, emphasize the fight. depending on the cultural context, the cultural background, right? And in Zen, we're very much learning, discovering our ability to pay bare attention to ourselves and to others, give feedback to ourselves and to our to others, without fighting or without fleeing or without freezing. That's really our practice. As a teacher, I want to give you feedback sometimes that will help you and support you, sometimes point out things to you that I don't think are helping you with this trick. I think you're tricking yourself more. And not freeze, but behind my robe, my robes or my position, whatever it is, you know. Sacred silence, we could say. Sacred silence is wonderful, but it's omnipresence. It's not some special thing. It's omnipresent. So instead of paying bare attention, what do? We avoid feedback. We avoid being in situations that are difficult for us. Zen priests all have to give talks. And Katagiri Roshi didn't care whether they were Zen priests or not. All of his students had to give talks. Anybody who signed up for a practice period. Because he wanted them to be attentive to exactly what their experience of Zen was. Even if it was anxious. Even if it was upsetting. Just to be there. And tell people straightly, with bare attention. When someone hears you talk genuinely from your heart, even if it's about anxiety, it helps them. And they feel part of you. They feel connected to you. That very act opens you up to realizing the wave is the ocean. So we have lots of Zen activities that really focus on this. And of course, in Buddhism, we emphasize using support people to help you too. And that's true, we do that in Zen, but less. Because if I'm having a problem with Rosemary and I run to Monica every time, I'm not really working with my bare attention. I'm not working with my bare attention. I'm not working with my relationship with Rosemary. And that's not so cool. That's not, in a way, I've tricked myself into thinking that what Rosemary's doing to me is a danger. But whatever she says, I'm not in danger. I'm not in danger. That's just my trick. And by running into Monica's arms, who's going to support me, that's not going to help me in my Zen practice. It's not going to help me. Right? And we also need to pay attention to how we use objects to get away from our anxiety. We use food to get away from our anxiety, our fear. We use, I don't know what you use. Choose your, tell me what you use. Hundreds of things, right? Hundreds of things. Scads of things. And it's not bad. It's not you're a bad person. Just please pay attention to it. Please notice it. The minute you say you're bad, you're cutting the wave off from the ocean. You're cutting it off from the ocean. Remind yourself it's the ocean and then make your list. Make your list of each of those ways in which you avoid recognizing and opening up to the anxiety, which is the ocean. So, objects, including ritual objects, we use. Ritual objects. I mean, that's okay, but just be careful. You can have start with an altar in one room in your house. You can put an altar in all the rooms in your house. Pretty soon, you have altars in all corners of all of your rooms in your house. Well, that's okay if that's a reminder to you that your whole house is an altar. But if it's not a reminder to you of that, then scrap it. Scrap it. Because it's not helping you with your bare attention. It's helping you avoid. It's helping you ignore. It's helping you think somehow that the religious is different than the mundane. The spiritual, the calmness of the spiritual life is different than the unruly surf in the ocean. The ocean creates surf. It's the nature of the ocean to create surf. And then you can distract yourself. You can suppress your thoughts for a while, right? For a while. That's all counterproductive. That all reinforces the idea that you're in danger when you're not. You can have superstitious beliefs, right? Religions have full of beliefs. Lots of beliefs that will help you, right? And I won't knock Christianity now because that's not fair. At the moment, I mean, it might be fair with my, you know, it's not fair when the Christians aren't here to defend themselves. But Buddhists do this too. Buddhists say, "Oh, we're all free of this stuff." Oh yeah, give me a yeah, yeah, right. What about all this stuff about reincarnation and rebirth? Is that less superstitious than any Christian or Jews talk about heavens? And what about all these Buddhist heavens? Oh, we say, oh, they're just psychological. Well, a lot of Buddhists don't think that they're psychological. They think they're literal. What about all this karma stuff? People get fixated on karma, really fixated. It becomes a superstitious belief that helps us stay away from bare attention, helps us deal with our danger that we created in our minds. So, we maintain the trick in many, many different ways. But mostly it's by, one of the main ways is in anticipation. Anticipatory fear, anticipatory anxiety. Now again, if we're in a rock, there's a need for anticipatory fear and anticipatory anxiety. It's very important. We're going to into a certain war zone. We need to take care of ourselves. We need to prepare in every way possible. But most of your anticipatory fear and anticipatory anxiety in Minneapolis is not necessary. It creates an extra burden, and it's part of the trick. It's a key part of the trick that you've been playing on yourself. Unfortunately, your parents played that trick on you when you were really young, and you believe that. So, I mean, not that they tried to play it on you. They believed it too, right? That's been our cultural legacy to a degree, I think. Maybe in all cultures, but certainly in this culture. And then, not only do we have the anxiety and the fear, but what? We feel ashamed about the anxiety, embarrassed about the anxiety. Discouraged about the anxiety. Oh, I'm a Zen priest. I'm a Zen teacher here. I'm the head teacher. Should they know that I'm anxious before I go to sleep at night? Should I share that with them? I might be embarrassed. I'm supposed to be in great emptiness. Or something like that, right? Or something like that, right?
break.
Party. Embarrassment, because now we become ordained. You know, I have 11 people that I've ordained here. Now, those 11 people want to be good priests, so they are embarrassed to show their anxiety. And then that's the second layer that we as human beings do. The anxiety and then the embarrassment about the anxiety. The fear and then the shame about the fear. And then another thing we do, if we're not interjecting it, shame, embarrassing, we're projecting it, right? She did it to me. Cindy, you've been scowling at me during this whole talk. You're the reason. You're the reason. I'm in danger if I look at these guys. This back row. They're all scowling. Maybe they are going to diss me as a Zen priest and never come back. So I will turn and look at these guys. Right? We project. Always projecting. If we're not interjecting, we're projecting. So there's another, someone came to see me in Doksan a while ago, who'd been at another Dharma center, and I won't identify the Dharma center. And I said, well, it's great to have you here, and why are you here? And he said, oh, I like it here. I said, well, that's good. And how about this other Dharma center, where you were before, where you lived before? He said, well, the teacher didn't like me. And I said, oh, did you ever talk to the teacher about that? He said, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. And I said, well, how do you know he didn't like me? He said, well, he always frowned when he looked at me. And I said, well, was he frowning or just being serious? And he said, well, he was so serious it seemed like he was frowning. I felt like there was no room for me. But he didn't check it out. He just projected. And his projected was his whole reality. So he left that center. He moved from that state to this state to find a cheerful teacher. So I try to be as cheerful. So each of you has the capacity to understand this trick and to accept the anxiety, the fear, the discouragement that comes up. It comes up. It's part of life. It comes up. And to see that you're not in danger. And to begin to notice what triggers it in your bare attention. What triggers it? What's the pattern? How long does it last? How does it abate? That's part of your bare attention. To just see it. To just see it. Just to be with it. So that you can begin to see it's no more real than a scary movie. No more real than a scary movie. So, if your partner shows anger toward you, and you feel that you're in danger, what's going on? What's going on? Here's a chance for bare attention. Is it something about his tone of voice? Something else he does? Is it related to some experience you had as a child? Is that coming up? You don't have to be analytic about this. But often it's something, it's often related to some parental thing. Don't have to be therapeutic or analytic. You just see it. Just see it. How long does it last? The whole point is to demystify, to enhance the awareness, so that we can respond adaptively instead of fighting, fleeing, or freezing. And we do belly breathing in Zen. Belly breathing can help a lot. And we soften our posture. Don't try to maintain such a rigid posture in your sitting. Just soften it. we are maintaining our rigid posture somehow as a way of keeping the anxiety out sometimes, but just soften. Or we can bring the aggregates into view. That's another talk. You know, I've given that talk a lot of times. I'm not going to give that talk today. We can bring the aggregates into view as our bare attention. Bring the body into view. How's the body responding? What are the sensations? What are the perceptions? What are the emotions? What are the thought circuits that we're creating? Or we can just practice bare attention. So this is all about entering and engaging, so we can learn to become good surfers, and really enjoy surfing, really enjoy it, without even a surfboard. So, let's see. I think I could take a question or two, even though it's retreat and you know, talking too much, but I'll take a question or two, if there is one or two. Yeah.
So, when we feel threatened, whether we're in Iraq or we're on Lake Calhoun, Is anxiety actually helpful, or does it get in the way?
It definitely gets in the way. But it can be initially helpful just to see it. It gets in the way when we prolong it, when we turn it into a story, when we try to get away from it, when we expound on it, when we compare it, but the anxiety itself, before we do anything about it, is helpful. Because it's telling us something. But how long does that last? That lasts like a nanosecond. That's helpful. And if we can just be bare attention with that immediate anxiety, that's great. There I am, getting ready to go to bed, and I notice, oh, I don't want to go to bed. Well, that's helpful. I'm noticing that I'm anxious about waking up in the middle of the night and being in pain. And that anxiety helps me understand my pattern, helps me understand my fear. But then if I do all this other trippy stuff about it, you know, that's where I get off. That's where I've tricked myself into thinking that anxiety really is a sign of danger when it's just discomfort. When I see it's just discomfort, and I deal with it. That's anxiety, is discomfort. Does that make sense? Huh? Yeah.
The thing that I thought about along the same lines is, I think it's John Dale Lowery. The way he learned to meditate, he was actually in the military in war, and he noticed two guys who were more calm than anybody else. And asked them why they were calm, and they said because they were practicing. And they taught him, and so bare attention even in that situation.
Uh-huh.
I think he's still ready to fight or flight or freeze. He's probably more ready because he's more intuitive. But then you don't have.
That's right.
And you're also ready if you're going to die. You're also ready to die.
That's right. That's a very good example. That's very good. Yeah. So in our lifetimes, let's hope we don't have to practice in that situation, but we might sometimes. We might. And if we practice in this less externally stressful situation for enough years, then maybe we'll be ready to do that. You know, there are all these Zen stories about the samurai who comes up to the Zen master and is ready to stab him, and the Zen master just is so still that the samurai backs off. So, why not? Why not? Yeah, David.
I just want to extend your metaphor of the wave in the ocean. Uh-huh. That when we are very anxious, it's just that maybe there's a wave that we're surfing.
Uh-huh.
You made a comment when we make a judgment about ourselves, though, in the wave, like I'm not good enough or whatever kind of self-shaming statement,
mm-hmm. yeah.
we really cut ourselves off from the ocean, so we're not yeah. the ocean or the wave.
That's right.
We've removed ourselves from that.
That's
so
right.
So it's a psychological suicide. So in its essence, you're defining shame as psychological suicide. We cut that's ourselves off yeah. from our vitality, from yeah. our ocean.
That's right.
Being that the wave or the ocean
yeah.
itself.
Yeah, good.
And that's why shame is such a detrimental.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Anything else? Hi.
Just wondering, maybe myself anyway, I think I noticed that my spiritual was really driving it is this belief that I need to protect a self.
Uh-huh.
And that's really what's underneath.
Yes.
All these attempts.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Well, it's good when you can see that. When you can see that, great. Great. And you have to really pay close attention to see that. Uh-huh. And how does that work for you when you see that? And you just notice that.
I feel more free.
More what?
Free.
And more free. Uh-huh. Good. Good. Well, Marty,
when you discuss the noticing when these feelings come up, seeing the pattern,
mm-hmm.
Seeing what thought might have triggered it.
Mm-hmm.
In my formal practice of Shikong Taza, I try to not go into that.
Oh yeah,
and I wonder at what.
Well, I think in your formal practice you should not go into it unless it becomes it starts to haunt you while you're sitting here. During a retreat, sometimes a pattern starts playing itself out. Then I think, do it. But normally in retreat, I would say, just do the bare attention. Then outside, work on the pattern. But you never know what's going to happen in a retreat, right? Have you found that to be the case?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah.
Wondering if you could maybe just delineate. Sometimes when I hear you say bare attention, it actually sounds like inquiry.
Inquiry. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But then at other times it sounds like something different. I think it is slightly, but...
Well, that's interesting. Bare attention may lead to inquiry. It may lead to inquiry, but it's not intellectual inquiry. The act of bare attention is a sort of inquiry because we're just paying attention without any without looking for any conclusion, without any belief. So in a way, it is a sort of inquiry. And there is the who am I koan, which is, for me, the classical koan in Zen and in all religion, because ultimately we're trying to see through the illusory nature of the self. So asking ourselves, who am I, that's a wonderful koan, and that comes up often with the bare attention. But with the bare attention, I'm not talking about trying to do any particular inquiry. In a way, it is inquiry itself, because it's just looking without any belief. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Can you define inquiry?
Looking into. Yeah, looking into. Okay, well, we're going to be in two groups now. One group is going to go out and play, and the other group is going to stay in here and surf. So, and I'm going to stay with the surfing group for a while.
We're all going surfing.
Okay, all right. Good for you. I'm glad you're up for it, Monica.